nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
All right. So let's continue the discussion on retiming. Quick recap of retiming. Just like De Morgan's law allows you to move bubbles across gates, but of course changes the functionality of the gate, you can do the same thing with flip-flops without changing their I/O behavior. So you can take the flip-flop, the output of a gate, move it to the gate inputs, and you end up with two flip-flops at the gate's inputs. And from a functional point of view, these two circuits are exactly the same. Okay, and we said that this optimization for sequential circuits was proposed in the 1980s by Leisers and Rose and Sachs at MIT. Why would you want to do retiming? For multiple reasons. One simple use of retiming, very common use, is to make the circuit go faster. So we already have talked about techniques just to optimize the combinational logic through technology-independent optimization, technology mapping. We talked about specific circuit restructuring techniques for optimizing the delay. All of those are limited by the positions of the flip-flops, right? Given the flip-flops, they define the boundaries of the combinational logic, and within the scope of those boundaries, you can optimize the logic all you want, but the constraints placed by the flip-flops will limit the extent to which you can optimize the logic. Moving the flip-flops around is like taking gates from the output of the combinational logic and attaching them somewhere else at some other paths, or vice versa, right, depending on how you're moving the flip-flops. So in a sense, the boundaries of the combinational logic are being redefined. The combinational logic is being reshaped. So this is a different transformation. It gives you a different scope of optimization. Okay. So here's an example. If you look at the circuit, the original circuit has the longest path of 3 units. The delays of each gate are labeled in the gate. You have a path of 3 units. And by retiming the circuit, specifically taking the flip-flop at the two inputs of this gate, NAND gate, and moving it to the output of the NAND gate as shown here, now you cut this path of length 3 into shorter paths. So in this case, if you look at the new retimed circuit as shown here, the longest combinational path in the new circuit is of only 2 units, right? So either the path here or, you know, the path of length 2 units here, right? So you've taken a circuit, and by moving flip-flops around, you know that you can make the circuits go faster, right? And none of the combinational logic optimization techniques we've discussed in the previous modules can achieve this effect. So this is a new way of optimizing circuits. So in this lecture, we're going to talk about how do you do this automatically. So given a circuit, how can you automatically move these flip-flops around to the optimum position? So suppose you say that I would like the circuit to be the fastest it can be, just by retiming. Okay. So retime the flip-flops around to give me the fastest possible circuit you can. Or you may have a specific clock frequency in mind. You may have a frequency target which your original circuit is not meeting. And so you may say that here's the circuit, here's my frequency or clock period target. Currently, the circuit does not meet it. Can you retime the circuit by moving flip-flops around and thereby meet this new target, this frequency target? So let's try to answer those questions. We'd like to come up with automatic techniques to do that. We will represent the circuit, as we have often done, as a directed graph. It's slightly different in this case. This is not just a combinational circuit. It's a sequential circuit, so the graph is no longer acyclic, right? Most practical sequential circuits will have cycles in them. Of course, the cycles are broken by flip-flops, but nevertheless, the entire graph is, it's a directed graph. It's not an acyclic graph anymore. And V is the set of vertices in the graph, E is the set of edges. We also have weights associated with the vertices and the edges, and we'll explain in a moment what that is. Okay. So V is a set of gates. Sometimes you also have one additional vertex representing the environment, and we will see, you know, when that is useful. E is the set of wires in the circuit or edges connecting the two gates or any two gates. The delay of the weight of the vertices is set to the delay of the gates, right? And delays in general are non-negative numbers. You expect gates to have some finite non-negative delay. The weight of an edge is equal to the number of registers on the edge. So here, it's a little different from what you would, the intuitive thing that you would do, right? If you're given a circuit with these three elements, you might want to create a graph with a vertex for each of the gates and also a vertex for the register or flip-flop. Here, you do not do that. You ignore, when you're creating the graph and with the vertices and edges, you create a vertex for each gate. Notice that we do not have a vertex for each flip-flop. Flip-flops just disappear, and it's as if you have an edge directly connecting this gate to the other gate. Okay. So if you look at the graph, there is one vertex representing the gate here, right? That is the vertex C. And there's another vertex representing the gate, the OR gate here, which is vertex X. And there is this third vertex which represents the environment. Okay. What we mean by the environment? Well, the environment provides the inputs to the circuit and takes the output from the circuit. So, you know, that's the reason we provide the vertex here, the environment vertex. And interestingly, having this sort of environment vertex actually gives you some additional opportunity for retiming. What this allows you to do, for example, is says that you can take a flip-flop at the output of the entire circuit and move it back across the environment vertex and into flip-flops at all the circuit inputs. And the circuit is the same, right? It's like you're adding one cycle of latency, taking it from the output and adding it to the inputs. So that's the reason you have the environment vertex. It actually allows you to do that transformation as well, or extends retiming to also consider that scenario. But notice that here, I do not have any vertex representing the flip-flop. Instead, the flip-flop, the fact that you have a flip-flop on this connection between the AND gate and the OR gate is just translated to the edge weight of 1 along this edge. Okay. So imagine as if this gate is connecting to this gate, but because it's connecting through one flip-flop, you set the weight to 1. Okay. So in this case, in general, the number of registers or flip-flops on each edge also is a positive non-negative number, right? So if you have a direct connection between two gates, without any flip-flop, the weight will be 0. If you have one flip-flop, the weight is going to be 1. Although it's not common, you may have two or more back-to-back flip-flops as well, in which case you'll have a larger weight. Okay, you may not intentionally do it, but maybe because of retiming, sometimes that might result, that kind of a structure might result. Or maybe when you're trying to intentionally add multiple cycles of latency to a signal, you might have a weight of greater than 1. But in general, the weights of edges are non-negative, the weights of the vertices are non-negative. Okay. Once again, the weights of the vertices are just the gate delays, so that gate here has a delay of 2, so you label the corresponding vertex in the graph by 2. The gate here has a delay of 3, so you label the corresponding vertex by 3. The environment vertex doesn't have any delay, so you label it by 0. And the edges in the graph just correspond to how many flip-flops you will encounter when going from the corresponding gate to the other gate. Right? So there's only one flip-flop here, so you have a weight of 1 there. Okay. So any questions about how you represent the circuit as a graph here for retiming purposes? And this graph, of course, as you can see, has cycles in it. Okay. Okay. What would a graph like this look like? So you know that this is a different circuit. In fact, this is the same as the original circuit, except we have retimed the gate, the AND gate, by moving the flip-flop back to the inputs of the AND gate. So what would the graph representation of this circuit be? If I gave you this circuit and said, come up with the graph representation, what would it be? It would be the graph would be the same, right? The vertices are still the same because, you know, flip-flops don't appear as vertices in the graph. So the graph, the set of vertices and connections are exactly the same. The vertex delays are also the same because the gate delays have not changed. The only thing that has changed would have changed in the graph you would construct for the retime circuit is that the edge weights will now be different, right? So here what we've done is we have lumped the connection from A to the gate and B to the gate as essentially one edge from the environment. So what we will essentially do is we'll take the flip-flop from here and we are putting flip-flops here. So instead of, so this edge would have a, in the graph for the retimed circuit, the edge from C to X will have a weight of 0 and the edge from the environment to C will have a weight of 1 because you have one flip-flop on each of those inputs A and B. So the graph structure is going to be the same. The only thing that has changed when you retime the circuit is that the edge weights have changed. And that is precisely the reason why you formulate it like this. Okay? We would like to think of retiming as a process of changing the edge weights. Yes, Prateek?
In case we have two flip-flops on B, then how would we
represent? If you have two flip-flops on B, then you would not be able to merge these two vertices, merge these two edges. Then you'll have two edges going from I to C. Okay. And later on, we will see that for retiming purposes, for the purpose of computing a retiming, you need to only look at the lower of the two. Okay. And we'll see why that is the case later on. We'll see why that is the case. So remember, this is just an abstraction of the circuit. This is not a complete functional description of the circuit. You cannot simulate this. This is just a mathematical abstraction of the circuit for the purpose of calculating the best retiming. Okay. So, to rephrase your question, if you have multiple edges between two vertices and they have different weights, what do you do, right? You could either keep them as different edges or you could replace them. For the purpose of retiming, it is sufficient to replace them by one edge with the minimum of the weights of all those weights. Okay. So with this, any other questions of how you just represent the circuit as a graph? Okay. So key points, remember, registers do not appear as vertices. They become edge weights. Gate delays become vertex weights. Okay. Slightly more complex example, right? Here's a circuit with no inputs. It's a feedback circuit, right? And this is how you represent it, right? There is no input, so you don't need to have an environment vertex in this case. So the vertices here only correspond to the different gates here, right? Namely the XOR gates, the buffers, and the inverters. So each one has a certain delay as annotated with the edges here. And whenever you have a flip-flop, like from H to A, you have a flip-flop, so you add that as the edge weight of 1 accordingly. Okay? So you know, here's another example of how you represent the circuit as a graph for retiming. This is the weight of H to A, and the delay of the gate A, the inverter's delay, is being labeled here. Okay? Okay. Now, with this formulation, graph formulation, how can we perform retiming? We know that retiming is about moving flip-flops back and front, back and forth across gates, but how can we think of it in terms of the graph? So retiming is movement of flip-flops from the inputs of a gate to the gate output or vice versa. In fact, it doesn't have to be a gate. It can be an arbitrary block of combinational logic, and you can do the same thing to the entire block of logic. It turns out that the structural circuit transformation of retiming is completely equivalent to just labeling the vertices in the graph with numbers, with integers that represent the number of flip-flops that you moved across the gate, right? Given a circuit, if I tell you move one flip-flop across this gate, then that is, you can think of that as a label for the vertex for that corresponds to the gate, saying I moved one flip-flop across the gate. And we will adopt a convention that backward movement, that is movement of a flip-flop from the output of a gate to the inputs, is a positive label. And the other way around, moving from the inputs to the output, is a negative label. Okay. So for example, this is original circuit. If I retime by minus, this gate by minus one because I'm moving from input to output, then I'll have the circuit shown on the right. If I retime this circuit by plus one, I'll return to the circuit shown on the left. Okay. So this is just a convention. And the reason we choose this convention will be apparent when we look at how to mathematically represent the labeling and relate it to the number of flip-flops on the edges. On the corresponding graph representation of the circuit, here I've actually not shown the environment. This is just a fragment of a circuit. But if it were a complete circuit, I'd have an environment vertex. For now, it's just the three vertices corresponding to the, you know, two inverters U and V, and the AND gate is vertex X. This graph, graph corresponds to, can you tell me which circuit it corresponds to? The one on the left or the one on the right? The one on the left. Why? Because I have two edges with flip-flops. Correspondingly, the two edges have edge weights of 1, right? So this corresponds to the circuit on the left. So if I retime this by minus 1, the resulting graph will look like this. The graph structure is the same. However, I've taken these two edge weights of 1 and made them 0 because in the new circuit, I don't have any flip-flops here anymore. On the other hand, I have a flip-flop here at this edge. So the edge that goes here to whatever other gate will now have a weight of 1. Okay? Similarly, if I retime by this circuit by 1, I'll go back to the circuit before. Okay. So that is the basic operation in retiming. You are labeling the vertices of that circuit graph with numbers representing the number of flip-flops that you're moving backward or forward across that gate. So essentially, a retiming can be thought of or is perfectly equivalent to a vertex labeling. Labeling of a mapping of all the vertices in the graphs to some numbers, integers. Right? So mapping from V to Z. V is a set space of vertices in the graph. The new edge weights after retiming can be computed from the vertex labels. Because if I tell you this is my original circuit and I have the edge weights in the original circuit and I tell you I'm moving so many flip-flops across this gate, you can actually retime the circuit and then compute the new graph. And we know that the graph structure is going to be the same. Only thing that has changed is the new edge weights. So rather than going to the circuit and recomputing the new graph, you can directly, using these vertex labels, compute the new edge weights in the retimed graph. For example, if this were the initial circuit, these are the weights of the three edges, 0, 1, and 0. Suppose I tell you that I'm going to retime the circuit by labeling the vertices I, C, and X with 0, 1, and 0 respectively. This is the retiming. This is saying that I will not move any flip-flops across I, I will not move any flip-flops across X, and I'll move a flip-flop forward or backward. Backward across C. Backward is positive retiming. Okay? Backward across C. By doing that, so in other words, the label of C is plus 1, the label of these two vertices is 0. Essentially, what you do is you take the flip-flop here and move it there. So the new edge weights are 1 here, and this edge becomes 0. Right? So now these are the new edge weights. The weight, the edge between R, I, and C has an edge weight of 1, and the other two edges have edge weights of 0. So in general, these new edge weights can be related to these old edge weights purely by looking at these numbers. Okay? And the general equation is as follows. If you have an edge between vertex U and V, remember that if R of V is the retiming label of vertex V, if R of U is the retiming label of vertex U, and W of UV is your original edge weight, W subscript R of UV is the new edge weight after retiming. So WUV is your original edge weight, you're doing the retiming, and then WR of U, V is the new edge weight. You can relate the new edge weight to the original edge weight and the retiming labels of the two vertices involved in that edge using this equation. Right? WR, the new edge weight of U, V is the original edge weight plus R of V minus R of U. Why do we say plus R of V minus R of U? Because a retiming of vertex V, a positive retiming of vertex V, will move flip-flops backward across V. In other words, you're adding flip-flops into this edge. Whereas a positive retiming of U will take flip-flops away from this edge. So you're adding R of V flip-flops onto this edge, removing R of U flip-flops from the edge. The net number of flip-flops you added to the edge is R of V minus R of U. And you already had W of UV flip-flops on the edge. So this sum gives you the new number of flip-flops after retiming. So essentially what we are saying is, by viewing the retiming as a transformation or labeling of vertices, we can correspondingly write these linear equations that relate the new edge weights as a function of the retiming labels and the old edge weights. Okay. Now, are we interested in just edges? Remember, we are trying to do retiming. Let's say we focus on doing retiming to minimize the clock period. Okay. The clock period in combinational circuits or in sequential circuits in general is related to the longest paths in the combinational logic, right? The longest combinational path. So you need to look at what happens to an entire path when you do retiming. Not just an edge between two vertices, but entire path between two gates. Okay. So we define path weights and path delays. Just like we talked about edge weights and vertex delays, we define the path delay as nothing but a path is nothing but a sequence of vertices and edges, right? The path delay is nothing but the sum of all the vertex delays. That is, a path consists of a number of gates, and the summation of all the gate delays is the path delay. Of course, we are talking of only topological delay here, okay? So, retiming, normal retiming formulation only works with topological delay. There are ways of trying to get false paths removed and so on, but we'll only look at topological delay. So you just add up the delays of all the gates on the path, and that is the path delay. Just the usual notation. Okay. The path weight is the sum of the edge weights along the path. So if you have a path consisting of a sequence of vertices and edges, right, you add up the vertex delays on the path, that gives you the path delay. You add all the edge weights on the path, and that gives you the total path weight. Okay. So path weight is just the total number of flip-flops that are present on all these edges in the path. So if you look at this example graph representing a circuit, from now onwards, we'll just think of the circuit as a graph, right? Now that we know that it can be represented that way. So if you think of this retiming graph, if you look at the path from X to U to V, that's a path in this graph, the delay of that path is 6, because it is 0 plus 3 plus 3. It's just the sum of the gate delays or the vertex delays, vertex weights. So 0 plus 3 plus 3, which is 6. The weight of this path is the sum of the edge weights, which is 2 plus 0, which is 2. Okay. Now, with this definition of path delay and path weight, let me ask the question, what happens when you do retiming of the circuit? Retiming can involve any of the gates in the path. Okay. Of course, if it doesn't involve the path in any way, nothing's going to happen. But assuming that some of the gates in your path are involved in the retiming, they have non-zero retiming labels. What happens in the retimed circuit to the path delay and the path weight? Will the delay of the path change? No, it is just the sum of the gate delays, right? And the retiming doesn't touch the gates in any way. So the path delay does not change. The weight changes because you are moving flip-flops back and forth across each of these gates. So the new number of flip-flops, cumulative number of flip-flops in the path may be different. But what is interesting is that the path weight depends only on the labels of the first and last nodes on the path. It doesn't depend on the labeling of the intermediate nodes. For example, if you do a retiming of this graph by retiming vertex u by minus 1 and retiming vertex v by minus 1, this would be the new graph. Remember, retiming u by minus 1 actually means moving a flip-flop forward across u. So originally you have two flip-flops here between x and u. You're taking one of those and moving them to the output edges going from u. In addition, you're also retiming v by minus 1. In other words, if you retime only u, one of these flip-flops would be converted to a flip-flop here and here from u to y and u to v, but you also retime v by minus 1. So you take the flip-flop from u to v and further push it onto the next edge. So you have eventually the two flip-flops here and the edge weight here reduced from 2 to 1. Now, if you look at the path weight, we are interested in the path weight under retiming. We've retimed two vertices on this path. One is an intermediate vertex and one is the final destination vertex of the path. What happens to the path weight? Let's just go back to the original definition. The path delay does not change as we observed. The new path weight is 1. Okay? In general, the path weight depends only on the beginning point of the path and the end point of the path. In this case, u is a gate in the middle of the path, and my assertion is that retiming u will not change the path delay. The path weight. Why not? What happens when you retime u? You take a flip-flop from this edge and move it forward to this edge. Or vice versa, depending on whether the retiming is negative or positive. But the path weight is the summation of the number of flip-flops on all the edges. So you take it from here and put it there, but the sum remains the same. Retiming u alone will not affect the path weight. The reason the path weight has decreased is because you retimed v. Because you retimed v by minus 1, therefore the path weight has gone from 2 to 1. Retiming u had no impact on the path weight. Okay? So the path weight depends only on the labels of the beginning point of the path and the end point, because any retiming of intermediate gates on the path does not have any impact on the overall path weight, right? You add and subtract and things cancel out. It allowed you to retime d, and that's a very valid point. But so what you're saying is you could not have retimed v if you had not retimed u. Absolutely. Right? But that's a separate point. If you had retimed u alone without retiming v, the path weight would have still been 2 because you would have had 1 here and 1 here, and it would have still added up to 2. So the path weight has changed only because you retimed v. Okay. So for a path from vertex s to t, the retimed weight of the path is the original weight of the path plus r of t, the endpoint of the path, minus r of s, the beginning point of the path. So this is exactly the same way as you computed for an edge. The same thing holds for a path. You only need to look at the beginning point and the end point, and you can compute the path weight, the new path weight. Okay. So with that definition in mind, let us talk about what it means for a retiming to be legal. Okay. When is a retiming legal? Suppose I give you an arbitrary values of integers to all the vertices, right? Labels. If I pick arbitrary labels, in general, will it always be a legal retiming? Is any combination of numbers acceptable? The reason any arbitrary retiming or labeling of the vertices may not be legal is because it can result in negative edge weights. In practice, you know the edge weights represent the number of flip-flops on the edge. What does it mean to have a negative flip-flop on the edge? Right? You cannot go back in time. There's no way you can have a negative flip-flop on the edge. Okay? So retiming is legal only if WR, the retimed edge weight of E for all edges in the graph, is greater than or equal to 0. So you have some constraints. You cannot pick arbitrary numbers for the vertices. Right? You need to ensure that the final retimed edge weights are all 0. So you cannot, because you cannot have any edges with negative flip-flops. For example, If you retime U by plus 1, right, it'll result in, remember, retiming U by plus 1 means moving a flip-flop back across U. That'll mean you need to borrow a flip-flop from these two edges and move it back to this edge, and you'll have three flip-flops on these edges, but you'll have a negative 1 flip-flop on those two edges, so that's not a legal retiming. On the other hand, retiming U by minus 1 is legal because you're taking the flip-flop from here, two flip-flops, taking one of these two flip-flops and pushing them forward to the outputs. Okay, so a legal retiming is just telling you that the new graph has a real circuit equivalent that you can transform it back into. But it doesn't tell you anything about whether the new circuit, retime circuit, meets the target clock period. Okay. So how do you represent the clock period constraint mathematically? This is a little more involved, but basically we're asking the question, when does a network meet a given clock period? So in order to answer this question, given a graph representation of the circuit, when does it meet a given clock period? We define two terms. We define W, which is called the path weight between any two vertices Vi and Vj. So your circuit has a bunch of vertices. They may or may not be directly connected by an edge. So Vi and Vj are two arbitrary gates in the circuit. Okay. So W of Vi Vj is defined as the minimum of the path weight over all paths from Vi to Vj. Sorry, for some reason this J has been truncated. It appears like an I, but this should be a J. Okay. So the minimum path weight between two vertices in a circuit . So this is my circuit. I have Vi, Vj somewhere else. In general, I could have multiple paths. I could have multiple paths from Vi to Vj. Each of these may have different numbers of flip-flops. Okay. For each path, you have a certain number of flip-flops. That is your W of, you know, Vi dot 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 Vj, because this path may go through several other intermediate gates and eventually reach Vj. That is the number of flip-flops. I take the minimum number across all these paths and I call that the min path weight, W with a underscore or a bar underneath it, okay, over all paths from Vi to Vj. D of Vi comma Vj is the maximum delay of all those paths that have a weight equal to the minimum weight. Okay. So remember, D is not the maximum delay across all the paths. First, I compute the weights of all the paths and I figure out the minimum weight. Okay. And then I look at a subset of these paths, because more than one path may have that minimum weight in general. So I look at that subset of paths which has that minimum weight, and among that subset, I compute the maximum delay across all those paths, those subset of paths. Okay. Is that clear? Why do we think we are doing it? Why are we defining these terms in order to ensure clock period constraints are met? Why do we only care specifically? Why are we only looking at minimum register count paths, and why are we only looking at the maximum delay among those paths? Remember, eventually clock period is about the longest combinational path. Okay. This is my original circuit. Remember that the register counts on these paths are affected only by the retiming labels of the end vertices. The intermediate vertices do not matter. This is where that observation comes in. So the endpoints and begin points of all these paths are the same. So how will all these paths be impacted by a retiming? Suppose I give you R of Vi and R of Vj, all the paths register counts will change by exactly the same value. All of them are dependent purely on R of Vi and R of Vj. Right? So all these paths either will increase in the number of flip-flops by exactly the same, or will decrease, or will all remain the constant. All of them will move in unison, synchronously, okay, in terms of what happens after retiming. Now, we care about paths that can potentially become combinational. The path may originally be combinational, or after you retime it, it may be combinational. You need to only worry about paths that can potentially become combinational. Which paths can potentially become combinational? In your original circuit, of course, you may have some paths with zero path weight. And those are combinational paths. Of course, those matter for the clock period. Right? And you know that path weight can never be negative, because you'll have at least, you know, edge weights are non-negative, therefore some of the edge weights also is non-negative. So zero by definition will be a minimum weight path. So you're, at least in that case, if you have a few combinational paths, they will be the minimum weight paths, and you will be looking at the longest delay among those paths. So that makes sense, right? Because when you talk about clock period, you care about between pairs of vertices, you care about the longest combinational path between them. Of course, we are not doing this only between one VI and VJ. We'll do it between different pairs of VI and VJ in the circuit, right? So we are ensuring that anytime you have a combinational path, it's going to be, but we will look at its delay, the maximum longest combinational path. Okay. The reason, but in the original circuit, I have some combinational paths. I'm ignoring, and other paths have at least one flip-flop or more. After retiming, things may change. Why am I still ignoring the other paths? Why am I only considering the paths with the minimum W? Again, remember, under retiming, all paths will change equally. So still, the paths which will become combinational or remain combinational is only these original combinational paths. A different example. Suppose W bar of VI VJ is 1. That means there are some paths which have only one flip-flop on them. Other paths have more than one, two or more. Under any retiming, the path with one flip-flop, the paths with one flip-flop will become combinational. And you'll have to stop there because they cannot have negative edge weight. You're going to ensure a legal retiming. So only those paths, it's only those paths that you need to care about. The paths with two or more flip-flops will remain sequential because the lowest they can drop is to one flip-flop. And that's still a sequential path. You don't care about a sequential path. So you look at the minimum register count paths or minimum flip-flop count paths because those are the ones that can potentially become combinational under retiming. Okay. That's why you look at that. And you take the max delay across those paths because you care about the maximum combinational path. Yes.
There could be a path between two flip-flops that is longer than the potential combinational path that we might reach. And if we have a path with one flip-flop and a path with two flip-flops, but between these two flip-flops at the top,
sure,
we have a longer combination.
Excellent point. But then this would be some other VK and VL, or VN and VM, and you should also look at the path between these two. So I'm not saying you only pick one VI and VJ. You need to pick different pairs of VI and VJ. So then you will ensure that as well. But for one VI and VJ, this is what you look at. And then you need to look at different VIs and VJs. So you compute these two matrices, and this, remember, given a graph, you can just compute these, right? These are just a property of the graph structure and the edge weights and the vertex weights. So if you have a graph like this, for example, as shown here, if you look at V1 and V4, what is the minimum register count path between V1 and V4? Well, there's two paths between V1 and V4. One is this one, and the other is the path shown here, right? So either V1, V2, V4, or V1, V2, V3, V4. And the minimum register count path is 1, which corresponds to V1, V2, V4. And the delay of that path is 3 plus 3 plus 7, which is 13. Okay, so in this case, for 1 and 4, V1 and V4, W bar of V1, V4 is 1, and D bar of V1, V4 is 13. In this case, the max is only over one path, so it's trivial, but if you had multiple paths, you'd take the max across all the paths with the register count equal to this minimum value. Okay. So this is a theorem that states what it means for a circuit, a retimed circuit, to satisfy a given clock period, T. Given a circuit, it is feasible, timing feasible, meaning that it satisfies a clock period T, if and only if W bar of VI VJ greater than or equal to 1 for all VI VJ such that the D bar is greater than that clock period. Put differently, any two nodes that will have a D bar of greater than T should have at least one flip-flop cutting that path. All paths longer than the clock period must be sequential. This is just the dual of the statement that all combinational paths must be less than the clock period. I'm just restating that by saying that all paths greater than the clock period must have at least one flip-flop on them. Okay? And again, note that we look at all VI VJ, not just one VI and VJ. Okay? So for all VI VJ, such that this D bar value is greater than T, you have to have W bar to be greater than or equal to 1. So if you look at this circuit, is this circuit timing feasible for a clock period of 13? Look at all paths which have, well, look at all, it's not an easy question to answer. Strictly, you need to compute the W bar and D bar and look at all the vertex pairs that have D bar greater than 13, greater than 13, and ensure that their W bar should be at least 1. But by inspection, you can see that anytime you have a combinational path of, so this V4 and V5 will add up to greater than 13. So this is 7 plus 7, that's 14, but it's broken by a flip-flop here. Similarly, V1, V2, V3, V7 also is greater than 13. So again, it's broken up by a flip-flop here, and so on. So any path between of, or any sequence of gates which has a cumulative delay of greater than 13 in this circuit, you will actually see that it is broken up by a flip-flop. And you can verify this by actually computing the W and D matrices. Okay. Now, is the same circuit, if I ask you, is this timing feasible for a clock period of 7? Why not? 2-4, for example, right, is a delay of 10, and you don't have any flip-flop between. So, the delay of this path is greater than 7, right? So, given a circuit, we haven't still retimed it, given a circuit with edge weights and vertex delays, vertex weights, you can answer the question, is this, by computing the W and D matrices, you can answer the question, is this circuit timing feasible at different clock periods? Now, what you really want is to answer the question, given the circuit and given a clock period where original circuit is not timing feasible, can you now retime the circuit to make it timing feasible at that clock period? Right? So can you retime the circuit to make it timing feasible at clock 7? And let's try to answer that question. Okay. We'll talk about the general algorithm and try to illustrate it. So a retime network, G sub R, is timing feasible for a given clock period if and only if Ri minus Rj less than or equal to Wij. This is just restating the fact that the retimed edge weights can be non-negative, have to be non-negative. You cannot have negative number of flip-flops after retiming on any edge. And for every path or every pair of vertices such that the D bar of Vi Vj is greater than T, after the retiming, you need to ensure that you have at least one flip-flop in that path. Okay, so you need to ensure that the Wri minus Rj less than or equal to W bar of Vi Vj minus 1. Note that this W bar is before the retiming of the original circuit. This D bar, of course, is again on the original circuit. Okay. So what this is saying is if you have a path here from Vi to Vj with delay greater than T, you're moving Rj flip-flops back into this path and you're moving Ri flip-flops out of this path. In fact, not just this path, all paths between I and J will have exactly the same effect. They'll have Rj flip-flops added to them and Ri flip-flops removed from them. All paths between I and J. But of course, you don't care about all paths. You only care about the paths that have the minimum flip-flop count because they are the ones that will become combinational, that can potentially become combinational, right? So this, all that this constraint is telling you is that you start off with some minimum weight here. And if this minimum weight was zero, for example, if you had a combinational path of length greater than T between Vi and Vj, what this tells you is that after retiming, you should have at least one flip-flop left on that path, right? Ri is the number of flip-flops removed from the path. Rj is the number of flip-flops added to the path. You have to remove, so Ri minus Rj should be less than or equal to minus 1. That means you should at least add one flip-flop. You should at least remove minus 1 flip-flops. Or equivalently, you should at least add one flip-flop to that path. The retiming should do that. So this is, enforcing these equations or inequalities will tell you whether under a given retiming of the circuit, whether the circuit will now meet the clock period constraint T. Okay. So now, the problem of retiming for minimum clock period can be restated as follows. Given an original circuit graph representation of the circuit, find a legal retiming R, which is a labeling of all the vertices, that minimizes the max over all the paths for which the WR is zero, maximizes the maximum delay of all those paths. In other words, minimize the maximum, the longest combinational path, right? This max is across all the combinational paths because combinational paths are the ones that will have edge, the path register count to be zero. And you want to minimize this quantity C itself by choosing the appropriate retiming. How do you do that? Let's look at an overview of the algorithm, and then we'll go through the different steps. First thing we do is we compute the register weight matrix W bar and the delay matrix D bar of the original circuit before you retime it. Again, just recap, W bar of U, V is the minimum register count among all paths between U and V. D bar of UV is the maximum delay among the paths with that minimum register count. You sort the elements in D bar and perform a binary search on them. One of the interesting properties of this matrix D bar is that the optimal clock period of the circuit is actually going to be one of those entries in D bar. Because one of those entries in D bar will be the longest combinational path that will, you know, be the minimum clock period that is achievable. So you don't need to look at arbitrary values of delay. You only need to look at the elements of that matrix D, the D bar matrix, and sort those elements, and you can just do a binary search on them, because a priori you don't know what timing period is feasible. For each period, you try to retime the circuit to meet that period and see if you're able to meet it. So for each element of this sorted list of elements in D bar, you construct a bunch of linear inequalities which specify the constraints for legality and timing feasibility of the retiming. The fact that the retime circuit cannot have negative flip-flops on any edge, and in the retime circuit, the longest combinational path should be less than T. And then you solve this set of linear inequalities, see if you can solve all these constraints together. And the answer to this may either be yes or no. If the answer is yes, it is a set of retiming labels for all the vertices that will actually result in the circuit meeting the clock period, the retime circuit meeting the clock period. If the answer is no, it means that clock period is too aggressive. So the lowest T for which you succeed in solving these linear inequalities is going to be the minimum clock period of the circuit. Okay? So that's the overview of the retiming algorithm. And this is just the same thing restated in pseudocode. Okay? So given the circuit graph G, you initially compute the W and D matrices on the original circuit, sort the elements of D, and that's this array of candidate clock periods that you try out for each, and you can do a binary search on this linear or binary search if you want to be a little more efficient. On this array of candidate clock periods, you construct the inequalities that try to search for a legal retiming of G such that the clock period T is satisfied, and solve those inequalities and return the optimal clock period and, of course, the retiming to achieve that clock period that is determined by the last successful solution of these inequalities. So just restating the same thing in pseudocode. Let's look at each of those steps and see how they can be performed. What is interesting about this entire retiming formulation is that although we are dealing with paths, none of these steps actually needs to explicitly enumerate all the paths. We know that the number of paths in combinational circuits is very large, or sequential circuits in general. The number of paths between two vertices, if you have to take all possible paths, especially when you have structures with reconvergent fan-out, you end up having a combinatorial explosion in the number of paths. So you don't really need to, even though for the definition of W and D, we conceptually talked about all the paths and looked at the minimum register count paths and maximum delay among them, you don't actually go path by path. You do not enumerate paths. So it turns out that a well-known algorithm that is used for finding shortest paths between pairs of vertices in a graph, it's known as the Floyd-Warshall algorithm, and it's used to, might be familiar to some of you who've done an algorithms course, like 608 here at Purdue. It's used to solve the problem of finding the shortest paths between all pairs of vertices in a graph. Why do we need all pairs? Because remember, you cannot just assume one VI and VJ. You need to consider all possible VIs and VJs. So the Floyd-Warshall algorithm, it turns out, can be used to directly compute both W and D bar matrices in one shot. So before we talk about how you compute W and D using the Floyd-Warshall algorithm, here's a quick review of how this algorithm itself works. Okay. Given a graph, the Floyd-Warshall algorithm works only with graphs that have edge weights. So it looks at an edge-weighted graph. And of course, our graph, retiming graph, has both vertex and edge weights. We'll see how to convert that into a edge-weighted graph. But the Floyd-Warshall algorithm, given vertices, edges, and weights, will do, it's basically a bunch of nested loops. Initially, what it does is for I equals 1 to V, J equals 1 to V, if there exists an edge between vertices VI and VJ, then it sets this UIJ, entry value of UIJ, to be the weight of the edge. Otherwise, it sets UIJ to infinity. Infinity, in this case, can be some very large number, right? When you actually practically implement this algorithm. Then, you have this nested set of three loops where all you're doing iteratively is that you take a pair of vertices, I and j, and you look at all other vertices, k, and you say that if uij, which is the current value of the shortest path that the algorithm has discovered between I and j, if uij is greater than uik plus ukj. In other words, what you're saying is, I have a graph, I have vertices I and j, I have another vertex k, and the algorithm is an iterative algorithm. It initially, you say that if you have a direct edge between two vertices, the path length between those two vertices equals to that edge weight. Otherwise, it is infinity. And you keep replacing uij with the shortest length of the paths that you have discovered between I and j. And each step of the algorithm, all that it does is it compares your current uij to ukj plus, uik, which is the shortest path from I to k, plus the length of the shortest path from k to j, right? So essentially all that you're saying is, I could stick with my current path that I've seen, which is the shortest path, or I could go from I to k and then go from k to j and use the shortest paths that I've seen thus far for each of those cases and add that as an alternative way of getting from I to j. And I look at which is better and I just keep the better value. That's all this is doing. If uij is greater than uik plus ukj, then you set it to be equal to uik plus ukj, because this is a shorter path than what you currently have. By iteratively doing this, in these three nested loops, each of which goes from 1 to the number of vertices, this algorithm eventually will actually compute the shortest paths between every pair of vertices in the graph. Complexity of this? Straightforward, right? V cube. Well, you have a V square loop there, but it's V cube because this loop dominates the complexity. So it's cubic in the number of vertices in the graph. So this is how the Floyd-Warshall algorithm works. But our interest here is, how can you compute the W and D matrices in one shot using this Floyd-Warshall algorithm? So the first thing we need to answer is that the Floyd-Warshall algorithm deals with edge-weighted graphs. We have a graph that is both vertex and edge-weighted. So what we need to do is you convert our original graph's vertex and edge weights, that is the D's and W's, into a two-dimensional weight for each edge. Okay? As far as the Floyd-Warshall algorithm is concerned, if you have in your circuit graph, if you have an edge between U to V, you consider its weights to be W of E, which is the number of flip-flops on that edge, and minus D of U. Okay? Minus D of U, because D of U is a positive number representing the delay, and we would like to have maximized the delay. So if you put a negative sign in front of the delay because we are computing the shortest path, you will get the largest delay. Okay? So you have this pair, the weight is now a two-dimensional number with these two parts, two dimensions. One is the W, the edge weight of your original circuit graph. The other is the negative of the weight of the source vertex, the delay of the source vertex. Then using this as the weight, you execute the Floyd-Warshall algorithm, okay, and compute the weight of the shortest paths joining each pair of connected vertices using the Floyd-Warshall algorithm. And in this case, in the Floyd-Warshall algorithm, we need to do two things. We need to compare uij to uik plus ukj. So you need to be able to add these two-dimensional edge weights, and you need to be able to compare them with each other. So the way you add the weights is by performing dimension-wise addition. So if you have, two pairs, you add the corresponding values of the w's and the d's. And you compare the weights by using W as the primary key and minus D as the secondary key. Okay? So, and this essentially will ensure that you will be only considering paths with the minimum register count. Right? Because first you look at W, and then if the W is a tie, then you look at D, minus D as the secondary key for comparison. So this ensures that you compute W and D the way we defined it. Okay? And so eventually, once the algorithm, Floyd-Warshall algorithm terminates, you, for each shortest path weight that you have between two vertices U and V, you set the W to the first component. If X, Y is the two dimensions of the final solution, you set W to the first one and D to D of V minus Y. Because the way we compute the weight here doesn't include the delay of the destination vertex. And of course, the weight itself is negative. So you need to take minus of that weight of that path that the Floyd-Warshall algorithm returns. And then you need to add the destination vertices delay. And then that gives you your D-vertex matrix. So essentially by using the Floyd-Warshall algorithm, you're casting the problem we have in terms of a all pairs shortest path algorithm and computing both these W and D matrices. So basically what you do, so illustrating the first step here is the edge from 1 to 2 is replaced by this, originally had an edge weight of 1, it's replaced by this pair 1, minus 3, where minus 3 is because the delay of V1 is 3, so you add the minus 3 here. Similarly, this edge here is replaced by the edge weight is replaced by 1, minus 3 because delay of V2 is 3. This edge between V3 and V4 is replaced by 0, which was the original edge weight, and minus 3, which is the delay of the source vertex, V3 of that edge, and so on and so forth. Okay? So you have the graph that we have, that we constructed representing the circuit. You transform it into this graph where edge weights are tuples and run Floyd-Warshall algorithm on this graph. Okay? And then eventually the results, the shortest path values between pairs of vertices here will give you your W and D matrices as shown in the last step. Complexity, of course, is order of V cube. Okay. But certainly much smaller than enumerating all the paths, which is potentially exponential, right? So that's a good thing. Computing the W and D matrices, I'll leave you to work this out as a homework example, but if you go through that process for the circuit graph shown here, you will end up with a W matrix that looks like this. Remember, W's are going to be non-negative, okay? And D's are also going to be non-negative, so this is your D vertex, or the D matrix, okay, shown here. Okay, so now, once you have these W and D matrices, given a clock period, you need to construct inequalities, the linear inequalities, that will tell you whether it is possible, will formulate the question, is it possible to retime the circuit to operate at this clock period, right? You need to reformulate that as a bunch of linear inequalities. How do you do that? The constraints will essentially guarantee that the retiming is legal and both timing feasible for a given clock period. And these are the constraints. I mean, you know, we've already seen these constraints. You say Ri minus Rj less than or equal to Wij for all edges in E. So you cannot, the retimed circuit cannot have negative flip-flops. And then you also say that Ri minus Rj less than or equal to W of Vi Vj minus 1 for all Vi Vj such that the delay is greater than T. So for a given T, you go through that matrix, the D matrix that we've seen here, go through the D matrix, look at all the entries where the D matrix's entries are greater than T, the clock period you have in mind, and for all those entries, you need to write down this equation. Okay. The first equation is for all edges that you have in your graph. The second equation is only for those entries which have the D, pairs of vertices that have the D value to be greater than T. And this is just saying that all paths of delay greater than the clock period you have in mind should have at least one flip-flop on them in the retime circuit. Let's look at an example of how you do this. So here's the graph you start off with. Simpler one here. Just four vertices. Compute the W and D matrices shown here. Suppose you would like a clock period of 7. You'll see that all the entries in the D matrix, which are greater than 7, are shaded in blue here. So you have two sets of inequalities. The first set is just representing the fact that you cannot have any negative edge weights in the retime circuit. So if you look at every pair of vertices connected by an edge, you have A and B connected by an edge of weight 2. So you say that RA minus RB should be less than or equal to 2. Similarly, B and C are connected with an edge of weight 0. So RB minus RC less than or equal to 0. This will just ensure that after the retiming, none of the edges will have negative weights on them. Okay. Then you have so this is the first set of constraints. You do this one for each edge in the original graph. The second set of constraints will go over all the blue entries of the D matrix, which are greater than or equal to or greater than the clock period you have in mind, right? So anything greater than 7 is highlighted in blue here. For each of those constraints, you will have a equation that you generate, and you generate these equations. So for example, you have the A and D. If you look at the entry of row A and column D, it is 13. It's greater than 7. So you generate this equation, R of U minus R of V, less than or equal to W of U, V minus 1. So in this case, U is A and V is D. So R of A minus R of D, less than or equal to WUV is 2, 2 minus 1 is 1, so you have 1 on the right-hand side. Does that make sense? Just write down this equation for all the blue entries or the entries in the D matrix which are greater than the clock period you have in mind. So for each of those blue entries, you have a corresponding equation as shown here. This is another bunch of equations. This is another set of equations. Put all of them together. And now, you just need to solve all these linear inequalities. What are the unknowns? The variables are your R's. The retiming labels of all the vertices are your unknowns. Find values of R, integer values of R, such that all these inequalities are satisfied. And then your circuit is going to be timing feasible at clock period T. Right? So what we've done is taken the retiming problem and completely reformulated it as a problem of solving, finding a feasible solution to a bunch of linear inequalities. These inequalities form what is known as an integer linear program. So they are all linear. A bunch of linear equations is a linear program, but we have the additional constraint that the R values have to be integers. So it's called an integer linear program. In general, unfortunately, ILP is solving an ILP, even to find a feasible set of assignments to all the variables, is NP-complete. Okay? Even the decision version of the ILP without any objective function. However, it turns out that in this case, the constraints have a very special structure. All the constraints, if you look at it, have this form, R of U minus R of V, where U and V are some vertices in the graph, less than or equal to constant. Since all of them have this special form, it turns out that the special problem structure allows you to avoid the worst case complexity. And it turns out you can actually use a very efficient algorithm to solve this in polynomial time, fortunately. Okay? So, yes, it's an integer linear program, but it has a special structure. So it's a special case, a special class of integer linear programs. And this result states that, you know, if S is a set of M linear inequalities in variables x1 through xn, which are all of this form, and all of our retiming inequalities are indeed of this form, xj minus xi less than or equal to aij, the problem of determining feasible values of these unknowns, if they exist, can be solved by using the Bellman-Ford single source shortest path algorithm. So it's again a shortest path problem, but a different kind of shortest path problem. Okay, the computing W and D matrices was a all pairs shortest path. This is a single source all destinations version of the shortest path algorithm. So you use a different algorithm known as the Bellman-Ford algorithm, which is more efficient. Okay. So we'll see how that works. So first, what you do is you take the retiming constraints and you represent these retiming constraints as a directed graph. Remember, we want to use a graph algorithm to solve it, so you need to have a graph in the first place. Now, this graph is not the original circuit graph. This is a constraint graph representing just the constraints. So, these are the constraints you started off with for the example we had. We represent this as a graph where you have a vertex corresponding to each of the unknown variables you're trying to find out. But of course, that corresponds to the set of vertices in your original circuit graph itself, because, you know, your R variables are in direct correspondence to each of the vertices in your original graph. So, the vertices are exactly the same as your original graph, or a one-to-one correspondence, but the edges here are different. You have an edge for each constraint. Okay? For each constraint, if you have RA, for instance, minus RB less than or equal to 2, you add an edge from B to A with a weight of 2. Okay? So, if you have a constraint here, you add an edge from, you know, V to U with the edge weight of that constant right-hand of the inequality. Okay. So, the number of edges here in this constraint graph equals the number of retiming constraints you wrote, the linear number of linear inequalities you wrote. Okay. Now, what you do is you add a dummy vertex, a source vertex, and add zero weight edges from this vertex to all the vertices in the graph. Okay. And then, you want to find the shortest path from this dummy vertex to all the other vertices. Okay? And it turns out that solution to this shortest path problem, the shortest path from V0 to all the remaining vertices, those shortest path lengths will actually give you these retiming labels that you want. Okay. I won't go into the why, but basically this is how you transform this set of linear inequalities to a graph problem, and you can solve it as a graph using a shortest path algorithm. So, this is the graph, the constraint graph representation. Again, edges correspond to the unknown variables you're trying to find, the retiming labels of the vertices. The vertices correspond to that. The edges correspond to each constraint. And you have this dummy vertex with zero weights of edges to connecting, directly connecting to each of the other vertices in the graph with the edge weight of 0. Now you want to find the shortest path from V0 to all other vertices. And this is the Bellman-Ford algorithm that does that. It sort of looks similar in structure to the Floyd, to the other algorithm that we saw, to the Floyd-Warshall algorithm, except that in this case, if you see that, you know, you have for I 0 to N, you set UI to 0. UI is the shortest path from V0 to vertex I. Okay, so set that shortest path to 0. For K equals 1 to N, you do, if for EI, all the edges in the graph, if UJ greater than UI plus W of EIJ, then you set UJ to be equal to UI plus W EIJ. So what you're doing in principle is something similar to here. You already have a way of going from vertex V0 to I and vertex V0 to J, but since you have an edge from I to J, you can also reach J by going to I and then taking that edge from I to J. And you see if that is a shorter route to get to J, then you replace UJ with this new possibility, new way of getting to J. Okay? And you keep iteratively doing this. So again, it has a very similar flavor to the Floyd-Warshall algorithm. You have this compare and replace step, and you just iterate it. In this case, you iterate it in this nested loop, where K is 1 to N, N is the number of vertices, and in the inner loop, you go across all the edges, okay, in the graph. And if you just do this repeatedly, eventually, you are guaranteed that if a solution exists, then it will be set to the final values of UI after this loop terminates will be set to the shortest path length. What do I mean by if a solution exists? Remember, in this case, the edge weights can possibly be negative. Okay, I'm looking for a shortest path from V0 to a certain vertex. If I have a negative cycle in this graph, I can keep going across that cycle over and over and over again, and I can go over it infinite times, so the shortest path length actually is not defined. It becomes minus infinity if you keep on going around that edge again and again, right? So if you have a negative cycle in this graph, what it means is that the set of retiming inequalities you started off with are infeasible. They do not have any feasible solution. Okay. So in order to detect that, you have this loop here, which basically checks for negative cycles. Okay. So you start off by setting this flag unsatisfiable to false. And for each edge EIJ, you check if this condition holds. If it holds for any edge, then it implies that there is a negative cycle in the graph, and you set unsatisfiable to true, and eventually at the end of this algorithm, if unsatisfiable remains false, that is, negative cycle has not been detected, then just setting the retiming label of the vertex to the shortest length computed by this algorithm will satisfy the retiming constraints that you started off with. If unsatisfiable is true, here at the end of the algorithm, it means the graph contains a cycle with a negative total weight, which means in turn that the constraints are unsatisfiable, which implies eventually that the circuit cannot be retimed to meet the clock period constraint that you have in mind. So you need to have a different clock period constraint. For a different clock period constraint, the entries in the D matrix that exceed the clock period will be fewer, hopefully. So you'll be constructing a new graph with fewer edges. And hopefully that graph now will not have a negative cycle. So you keep doing this until you find a feasible solution. Okay. Complexity of this is product of number of vertices and number of edges, right? The nested loop here, outer loop runs across vertices, inner loop runs across edges. So it's V times E. Okay. So let's look at an example here for the set of linear inequalities here. Same running example. This is the graph as we saw on the previous slide. It turns out that if you solve the shortest path problem, you'll see that the shortest path from V0 to A is of length 0. The shortest path from V0 to B is of length minus 1. Shortest path from V0 to C is of length minus 1. And shortest path from V0 to D is of length 0. Okay. So this is the solution eventually to your shortest path problem. And if you go back and retime, it means that you're retiming vertex A by 0, retiming vertex B by minus 1, which means that you move a flip-flop forward, take one of these two flip-flops and push it forward. So you do that to B, and you also retime C by minus 1, so you take the flip-flop that would have been on this edge after you retime B and push it forward one more step retime C by minus 1. So this is the final set of edge weights after retiming. Okay, and that's your retime circuit. And you can see that in this circuit, you do not have any combinational path of length greater than 7. Right? So you have 6 here, but you do not have any path of length greater than 7. So this is how, you know, sort of the overall process works. Start with your circuit graph. For a given clock period constraint, compute the W and D matrices. For a given clock period constraint, generate these inequalities. Solve the inequalities using the single source, all destinations, shortest path problem. And if you have a solution, that is, if there is no negative cycle, then take the shortest path lengths and set them to the retiming labels of the vertices, and that's your new circuit. So let's just put everything together, summarize the algorithm, considering what we've learned about each of the steps. First step is compute register weight matrix W and delay matrix D. Sort the elements in D and perform a search on those elements. For example, a binary search. For each element that you consider, construct the constraints for legal and timing feasible retiming. Construct this constraint graph and compute the shortest paths using the Bellman-Ford algorithm. The lowest T, in this process of searching through the different T values, the lowest T for which a legal retiming exists is the minimum clock period. And the shortest path lengths that are reported by the Bellman-Ford algorithm are the retiming labels of the vertices that will attain that minimum clock period. The complexity of this whole thing, you know, of course you have multiple algorithms here, but the complexity of the whole thing is order of V cube log V. Any questions? I know it was a bit fast, but good news is it's not covered on the midterm. So we can come back and talk about it a little more in the next lecture. You know, I just wanted to get done with this and leave some time for any questions you may have after we finish the lecture. But any questions on this, on what we talked about now? Okay. It's a pretty elegant procedure because, the combination of optimality and computational efficiency is not often seen in design automation. This is one of the rare instances where you can formulate a problem elegantly, solve it optimally, and in practice also it has a pretty big impact. You can, take circuits and optimize them all you want with only combinational synthesis, but then once you bring retiming into the picture, it adds a different scope or a different dimension of optimization and actually substantially helps improve the efficiency of circuits, the speed of circuits. We've seen how to do it for timing. But, it's a very powerful transformation because it changes the boundaries of the combinational logic. Rather than take fixed positions of the flip-flops and look at the combinational logic and optimize the combinational logic in isolation, this allows you to change the boundaries of the combinational logic. We have seen how retiming can be done for minimum clock period, leads to a very elegant formulation, as I remarked, using very efficient graph algorithms. But there's other variants. You can retime to minimize the number of registers. Registers are quite power-hungry, area-hungry. Okay. So, in fact, the clock network also has to, the number of leaves of the clock network is equal to the number of registers. So if you retime your circuit to minimize the registers, hopefully you're reducing the area and power consumed in the flip-flops or registers themselves, but also in the clock network. And so retiming to minimize the number of registers can also be formulated. It turns out it's also a polynomial time. There's an efficient algorithm to do it. We consider only topological load-independent delay model, where the delay of a gate is independent of the load. Well, when you move a flip-flop into an edge, now previously the delay of the gate was dependent on the capacitive load, which is the next gate it was driving, but now it's driving a flip-flop, not that other gate anymore. So you can actually consider that load-dependent delay model in retiming as well. Subsequent research also explored retiming to improve power consumption, improving testability. For test purposes, usually sequential circuits are very, very difficult to test. A common technique, I've talked about full scan design, where you take all the flip-flops in the circuit and convert them into one giant shift register, so that effectively, during manufacturing test time, you can deal with the circuit as a combinational circuit. Now, it turns out that the cost of this design for test technique is very high for a full scan, because you need to take a circuit may have 100,000 flip-flops or 10,000 flip-flops. You need to thread all of them into this one long chain of shift registers that goes through the chip. Partial scan, on the other hand, tries to only scan a subset of flip-flops. And one common approach for partial scan is if a sequential circuit is cyclic in nature, if you can scan a subset of the flip-flops such that you break all the cycles in the sequential circuit, then, the circuit is still sequential, but it has an acyclic structure. It turns out that those circuits are much easier to generate tests for. They are sort of pseudo-combinational, right? It's like a pipeline. It's acyclic in structure. So you can use retiming to position, remove your registers to such that the number of registers you need to scan to cut all cycles in the circuit is minimized. And that will minimize the cost of partial scan. Right? So there's multiple ways of, you know, using retiming to achieve different objectives. Of course, retiming for speed is what we studied in detail, but there's other variants, useful variants as well. And other remark I'd like to leave you with is that, you know, in terms of general principles, retiming constraints, although they formed an ILP, it again turns out that the problem has a special structure that enabled a much more efficient algorithm to be used, right? If in general you need to solve, you know, an ILP program, over a large number of variables, you know, this would have been a non-starter, right? Not from a practical point of view. But the fact that, the researchers were able to recognize the special problem structure and use much more efficient algorithms greatly helped. If you'd like to look at retiming, it's in Dimichelli chapter, the chapter shown here. In fact, I think this probably covers all of the sequential, this entire module, right? The FSM minimization, FSM encode, state minimization, state encoding, and retiming are all covered in these chapters in the Dimichelli book. Okay? With that, let's end the lecture.